Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Algentalk. Mein Name ist Boris Rogosch und in diesem Podcast treffe ich mich mit Menschen zum Gespräch, die alle auf die ein oder andere Art mit dem Thema Algen und Essen zu tun haben. Ich möchte herausfinden, was meine Gesprächspartner so faszinierend an Algen finden. Was macht diese so einzigartig und warum sollte man sie auf jeden Fall auch essen? Was lässt sich konkret daraus zubereiten und vor allem wie? Von Meeresbiologen über Algenfarmer bis zu Köchen sprechen wir über Algenanbau, Ernte, Umweltaspekte, die wertvollen Inhaltsstoffe, über Zubereitungsarten und natürlich auch über den Geschmack von Algen. Und in dieser Episode spreche ich mit Joachim Kjærl, dem Gründer von Havhøst, eine dänische Organisation, die den regenerativen Anbau von Algen, Muscheln und Austern vorantreiben möchte. Dieser Ansatz soll zeigen, wie nachhaltige Lebensmittelproduktion und die Wiederherstellung unserer Meeresökosysteme Hand in Hand gehen können. Joachim erklärt, warum diese Meereskulturen nicht nur eine nachhaltige Alternative auf unseren Tellern sind, sondern auch aktiv zur Gesundheit unserer Ozeane beitragen. Wir sprechen darüber, wie lange es dauert, bis Algen, Muscheln und Austern fester Bestandteil unseres Speiseplans werden und warum es so wichtig ist, junge Menschen für diese Themen zu begeistern und natürlich auch, welche Chancen sich für die neue Generation bietet. Außerdem geht es um die Pläne, die von Havhøst entwickelte Anbauplattform für Algen, Muscheln und Austern über Dänemark hinaus auszubauen und darüber, wie es gelingen kann, Küstenfischer für diese Vision zu gewinnen. Dieses Gespräch habe ich auf Englisch geführt, aber hoffentlich ist es für die meisten von euch gut verständlich. Ich wünsche viel Freude beim Zuhören mit Joachim Kjærl, dem Gründer von Havhøst. Dieser Podcast ist im Rahmen des Interreg-Projektes Alge Food entstanden. Die deutsch-dänischen Partner hinter diesem Projekt haben sich zum Ziel gesetzt, Algen in der regionalen Esskultur als Teil einer gesunden und nachhaltigen Ernährung zu etablieren und als Lebensmittel bekannter und beliebter zu machen. Und jetzt geht's los mit Joachim Kjærl von der Organisation Havhøst. Herzlich willkommen zu einer weiteren Episode vom Algen-Podcast. Und heute switchen wir mal ins Englische. Und er nickt schon. Joachim Kjærl. Und die Company, die Firma, das NGO, das er vertritt, heißt
Havhøst.
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 Ja. Ja. Great to be here.
Yes.
How is the area called here?
It's called the mountains, which is interesting for a country which is flat as a pancake. But these are the mountains, and we're like 60 meters above the surface of the ocean.
Okay, the mountains. On Zealand.
Zealand, on the western coast of Zealand. Yeah. Odsherred, Geopark, Odsherred. Yeah. A very nice place,
yeah,
if you ask me.
We're talking about blue water farming.
We call it regenerative ocean farming.
Oh, this is...
Yeah, and that's it's not always easy for everyone to understand it the first time they hear that word, but the important thing to understand is that it's farming in the ocean in a manner which is regenerative, which is to say that it brings life back to the oceans while producing food for people to eat.
Is that already common or being practiced somewhere else in the world?
It's not done a lot. I mean, it's like it's fairly novel when it comes to our parts of the world to look at the oceans as something that can be used to cultivate food. We're used to thinking of food from the ocean as something that you capture. It's something that you fish in nets. It's you try to catch stuff that swims away from you.
Yeah.
But the great thing about cultivating species in the ocean, like mussels, seaweed, oysters, is that they stay in the same place. So you don't have to sail away to try and catch them. And that's just one of the nice things about them. There are many other good things to say about them, but I'm sure we'll be getting back to that.
But oysters, mussels, and seaweed. This is something which grows naturally.
usually.
They grow naturally. They're found in oysters are a bit of a different story, but yeah. but at least mussels and seaweed is found along most of our shorelines. The further you get up into the Baltic Sea, the smaller the mussels are, and at a certain point they disappear completely because there's not enough salt in the water. But as soon as you move, you know, out into the outer rims of the Baltic Sea and in the North Sea, they are all over the place. And they just grow by themselves, and they lie there attached to rocks and attached to piers and attached to the bottom of boats. They're all over the place. And they just sit there filtering the water and taking out the nutrients that are in the water and converting the nutrients into protein. The most sustainable protein that you can get. It has like 1 kilo of blue mussels. When you cultivate it, produces about 2 kilos of CO2. So, and that's less than carrots. So they are amazingly climate friendly food. And they just grow there. And as they grow and turn into this wonderful protein that you can eat, they rid the ocean of all these nutrients that we don't really want there because they are disturbing all the living species in the oceans.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a way, mussels and oysters and seaweed are fantastic answers to the answer of what are we going to eat in the future and where are we going to get it from.
How came this idea up? I mean, seaweed, I mean, is not popular in the kitchen.
No, it's not. Let's be honest.
Blue mussels, yes, okay. And oysters is a different story. You yeah. love it or you hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think there are definitely some cultural issues here because, you know, food culture is something, you know, it sticks and it's very hard to change food culture. It's something that happens over a long, long period of time, or it happens as a consequence of sudden change in your surroundings, which requires that you eat differently. Mm-hmm. And I would say that right now we are in at a point in time where something really, really big is happening, which will require us to reinform ourselves as when it comes to what are we going to eat? Mm-hmm. Because we're not going to be able to eat what we have been used to eating for the past 80, 100, 200 years. We need to completely alter our diets. So even though today seaweed is to most people probably something that you see, you know, as the sticky stuff when you go swimming, or you know, as something that you may accept as a part of a Japanese meal, but which has no place in your normal the food that you serve
you
to your families.
You would never eat a nori
never,
algae.
Never.
But beside rice and
exactly. But I'm here to say that. I think these things are going to change. I think we're going to not just in our part of the world, but in, you know, all over the world, we're going to see some shifts in food culture based on the huge changes that we're going through on this planet. And we're going to be eating seaweed. The thing is, of course, we need it to be super delicate, right? We're never going to eat with our heads. We will always be eating with our hearts and our bellies. Mm-hmm. That's where we make the real decisions about what we serve to our families and what we want to eat ourselves. So we need to somehow adapt seaweed and oysters and mussels into the existing food culture that we have, and we're going to find ways to fit it in. Maybe we're not going to be eating like, you know, just taking a leaf of seaweed and just, you know, slicing it with a knife fork and eat it. We need to find ways of integrating it into the food that we already eat in nice ways that make our food experience as eaters wonderful. You know, we need to experience that the food that we eat is giving us pleasure, because that's where food comes from.
It's pleasure and has something to do with memories. I mean, if you when you eat, I mean, we all think about, oh, that was, I had that dish as a child, grandma cooking, mother cooking, whoever, and this is, if you taste that, if you have that in your nose, you say, well, okay, I feel home. And with seaweed, because it was not on the table, on the plate, so that's why it takes a longer time, but
it's a long journey. But we've, but what we've done in Hauhurst is also that one of the things that we do is that we have a lot of educational activities going on, because, you know, we need to kickstart cultural changes with our children. You know, you and I, we're probably too old to ever really change.
I may be too old, you're not, but I'm open to that.
Yeah, but really, I think the kids are where we need to start. And I mean, so,
and you mean they hear it, they taste it at school, they try it, and go home and say, well, we tried seaweed today, and the parents say, what?
Are you serious? Yeah, exactly. And it was really delicious, right?
Yeah,
because I didn't eat it because a teacher forced me to eat it, or you know, a doctor said that it was good for my health. No, I ate it because it was outrageously delicate.
Yeah,
you know, that's where we need to go, and that's you know, that's a creative process when it comes to the people who produce food, you know, meals for people, including restaurants.
When did you start with that idea to cultivate that idea and bring it to the people, and how did you do it?
I think our journey started in the harbor of Copenhagen, trying to see if we could use the inner harbor of a big city for something besides kayaking and swimming and stuff, because that's what people were doing in the harbor of Copenhagen at that time. The heavy industry had left the harbor, so the water was clean enough for other activities to take place. And at that time, I was working with food and food culture and all of these things. And so me and one of my friends, we tried to cultivate oysters in the harbor of Copenhagen, which was a complete failure, because there's not enough salt in the water. But the story was really good, and people really, people in Copenhagen and in Denmark started noticing that we can cultivate stuff in the ocean and in near our cities, and maybe we can't cultivate oysters, but what other things exist that we can start cultivating?
Yeah.
And that whole idea of bringing food production, marine food production, into our cities, and, you know, letting people take part in it, that really got some traction and some interest from the world.
And you had some bigger thing in mind when you started that, or was it just an experiment to say, well, let's try it?
To be honest, I think the good story is that I had thought it all through from the beginning, and that I knew exactly where I wanted to go with it. But the reality is that, I mean, when you take a step down a path, you learn, and you take another step, and then, you know, things turn into a story.
Yeah.
You don't start with a story, I think.
No.
You know, the story is something that you look at in the rear view mirror. So for us, initially, it was about, we loved oysters. Let's be honest. So we wanted to bring oysters
that's
to the people of Copenhagen.
Yeah, for us, lovers.
For some of us, that's what really, you know, gets us up in the morning. So bringing oysters to the people of Copenhagen was really where I started. But but gradually learning, you know, that, you know, about regeneration and about the ecosystem services that these species can deliver to our oceans, which was really a wonderful, you know, bringing ocean conservation and food culture in the same mix. You know, yes, this is where we need to be, right? And this is where I need to be. So that gradually evolved from trying to use the inner harbor of Copenhagen to cultivate oysters.
And when was it?
I think 11, 12 years ago we started.
12 years?
Yeah, okay. And it was very small and very, you know, it didn't look like much, but somehow, you know, we got some funding at a certain point, and I started thinking that, okay, so this crazy hobby of mine, maybe it's something that I can actually, you know, start turning into my profession.
Yeah.
So gradually,
you had a lot of attention for the project. Yeah.
Definitely. And at some point it just, you know, I said, okay, so this is what I need to do. So I went on full time, and now it's real. I mean, cool. it's 30 cities around Denmark, and it's turning into something that other countries are getting interested in as well.
Saying 30 cities around Denmark, what are they doing? I mean,
yeah. So these cities, they are we call them blue community gardens. So blue,
yeah.
And basically they are small community led. Gardens where they cultivate these regenerative species,
like urban gardening,
in the water. So, and some of these organizations are maybe 15, 20 members, some of them are a few hundred members, but they all do the same thing. They have these platforms, most of them have platforms where they cultivate these crops. Some of them have open water cultivation as well.
Platform means a physical platform that swims in
physical
the water?
Physical platform, which is floats right there, and you have a small bridge that leads out to it, and all your crops are then growing beneath the platform. You have your oysters, your mussels, your seaweed. You have this multi-trophic space under the surface of the water. A hanging garden, basically, with all these crops hanging down through the water column, with fish swimming in it, and it's a huge, it's a super vibrant place where a lot of species come in and take refuge, because, as you probably know, we have taken out of the water most of the places where fish like to be. All the big rocks have been taken out of the water. All of the, you know, our bottom trawling has left most of our ocean floors as deserts. So we basically, these small gardens, they introduce a small place for some of these homeless species in the ocean to be. And at the same time, it's this place where the local gardens, they go down and they cultivate their crops and they take them out and they eat them and they share them and blah, blah. So it's completely non-commercial. It's based on just people doing something because
community
it makes
farming.
Sense.
Yeah.
It's a community. So we have these 30-something community farms set up around Denmark.
What's the space needed for that?
Most of them are, you can produce a lot of food on a very small space. We have a garden. I think they are 200 members, and I think their cultivation space is maybe 40 square meters.
40 square meters?
Yeah. So they have mussels growing there, and they pluck them, and they have some seaweed when it's season for seaweed, different species. And you can really produce a lot of food on a very limited space, which is why, one more reason why this form of cultivation is so nice, because it actually frees up space on land. Like if we move some of our cultivated areas to the ocean, we can free up space on land for nature, and we can have cultivation in the ocean.
Yeah.
Super efficient, super space efficient, if you do it in the right way.
If you do it in the right way, and do I need any permission for that? I mean,
yeah, permissions are definitely an issue, because all the legislation, all the rules surrounding cultivation in the ocean is based on huge industrial size plots. So, for instance, in Denmark, in the Limfjord, we have a mussel cultivation going on on huge areas.
Yeah,
and there are a lot of negative side effects to these very huge plots where you only cultivate one species. We should have learned that lesson, I guess, from having cultivated monoculture on land.
Nothing
new, and we've just basically, you know, let's not take what we've been doing on land and just do the same thing in the ocean.
Yeah.
Let's do it in another way. But we have these huge plots with mussels growing, but it's not really what we need to do.
But if I come to you and say, well, I'm in Germany and I would like to have a platform which you have constipated and built, and I want to grow, I mean, blue mussels and seaweed, Zuckertang.
Yeah.
Oysters, probably not.
Let's try it out.
Not manageable right now.
No.
So what do I have to do?
The rules and regulations are that I sort of got myself off the line there before, but rules and regulations are made for industrial plots. So having a small plot, small cultivation site, is really difficult because you need to apply for a permission as if you were a huge industrial farmer. So what we've been doing in Denmark for the past 10 years has been to work with the authorities to set up a new set of rules and guidelines for smaller farms with multi-trophic cultivation, meaning cultivation of more than one species within the same plot. And that has been a long process, and we're not all the way there yet, but it's easier now in Denmark. It's really, really difficult in other countries. So we need regulators, politicians, to look at this regenerative ocean cultivation as something that we need to make a fitting set of regulations for, so that it becomes easier for the farmer to apply for a permit, to get his permit, and to sell his crops. You know, there's also the whole issue of, you know, how do we tax different sectors in our food production system? Mm-hmm. Right now, taxation is not entirely, you know, aligned with our ambitions to produce climate-friendly food and food that is good for us and for nature. So, but if we start, setting up our regulatory systems in a way that actually promotes climate-friendly foods and ecosystem-friendly foods, then the whole economic side of being a regenerative ocean farmer would be so much easier, because make money just by cultivating, because you deliver ecosystem services to the ocean, right?
Yeah.
So, but you need to apply no matter where you're doing, in what country you want to set up these kinds of cultivation sites. You need to apply to the authorities. And in most countries, the authorities are probably going to say, we have no idea what you're talking about.
And I can imagine that happened here when you started.
Yeah, that totally happened here. So,
what
so,
are you talking about?
Yeah, that was a long process of getting to know each other and getting to know what we wanted to do.
But going back to the community, I mean, I can imagine that they are these multiplicators for others, and if you say like 30 cities have it, I mean, I don't know how fast it's growing. How many do you expect it within the next 1-2 years?
I think they will. I mean, they will continue to pop up.
Yeah.
And how? And the great thing, of course, in Denmark is that Havhest is there to help them set up their farms and their organizations and assist them. And, you know, because there are a lot of questions that you want to ask yourself when you're looking out into the ocean and trying to figure out how we can cultivate stuff out there. So, but there's a lot of experiences now in Denmark, and Havhest is there to help, you know, new gardens to set up, which of course makes it much, much easier. Mm. You know, if you start from scratch in somewhere and you know there's no one to talk to, no one to ask any questions, it's difficult. But I think in Denmark, I wouldn't be surprised if in 1 or 2 years we have maybe 50 or 60 gardens. But what we're also seeing now is that the whole idea of these sort of community-based cultivation models, they are getting interest from the countries around us.
Cool.
You know, so we're helping Swedish partners to set up. In Finland, we're working with a local organization to work like low salinity cultivation, because that's an entirely different species that you need to work with when you have such a low salinity. Super interesting. We're working with the Baltic countries and Poland and a German partner as well. So that's one of the places where I really see a potential for getting the message out and getting many more people involved, is all these different countries. So we set up now, we just launched a platform called Cool Blue Future for the Cool Blue Future.
Cool Blue.
Yeah. Cool Blue Future, which is where we have like guides and, you know, tutorials and stuff for new farmers who want to get started in all 9 languages. So everyone can basically get in there and hopefully learn enough to take away the anxiety and you know, just do it.
And on the same side, we have that change in our oceans that there is not much fish anymore. Talking about the Baltic Sea, for example, I mean,
yeah,
we don't get any fish. I mean,
oh, it's crazy.
And here, it's pretty much the same.
Pretty much.
On the North Sea, it's a little bit different, yeah. But there's a big change. I mean, yeah. In my area where I live, I think all the fisher boats have been sold.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's been, you know, the past 10, 20, 30 years, if you're a small coastal fisherman, you've just, you know, you've been a part of a story that, you know, most of us don't fully understand what is actually going on and what has been happening for the past 10, 20, 30 years. The fishermen have seen it from the first row. You know, just, it's gone. It's gone. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for us to understand, but it's like, just, we're sitting here in this beautiful countryside, just turn it into a desert. Remove all the trees, remove all the plants, remove everything living, remove every single animal.
Yeah.
That's what you have below the ocean.
Yeah.
And we just don't understand the magnitude of that. And it's just, it freaks me out to even think of it. But that is what is happening. And we're not seeing it because we only see the surface of the ocean. We don't see the destruction that we've been creating. And the fishermen have seen it and they've felt so the fishermen are, of course, you know, all the meetings that I've had with fishermen for the past 5, 8, 10 years, you know, they've just, you know, they're afraid and they're angry. They're super angry and they're super sad because, you know, this it's not their fault. It's like, you know, it's
farming.
And
they did the job over generations, yeah? And then they have to change.
And we've just fucked it up.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, and the irony of it all is that, you know, farming, industrial farming, has in effect killed its sister business, fishery. You have farming, you have fishery. Those were our two sort of primary production sectors for food. One of them has effectively killed the other one. But the great thing, obviously, is that, you know, for the fishermen, what we're bringing to them with regenerative ocean farming is a positive tale, you know, because there's a lot of negative, and I can definitely, as you can hear, I can also feel the negative sort of vibe, and but we need to have a more positive sort of approach to it, also to be constructive and say, okay, so what are we going to do now that we know that this problem is there and it's going to take 30 years, 50 years before we get anywhere near solving it? What are we going to do in the meantime? Let's try and create some visions for how we're going to develop our fishery into something that can help the process of reinvigorating our oceans, and at the same time creating food. That's the great thing about these crops. So we need our fish. We need to create incentives for our fishermen to start cultivating these species. That would keep them on the water. It would keep them, you know, as someone relevant in our food system, and it will make sure that we have local production of high quality, super sustainable food for our citizens. We need that positive tale of how are we going to develop our fishery.
And do you get positive feedback from that side?
More and more, I would say. Yeah, but we need a concrete positive examples.
Okay.
So now we're working with the first two fishermen in Denmark to set up small scale regenerative ocean farms with them, where they're going to cultivate seaweed. Hopefully also oysters and mussels at some point.
Yeah.
But we need some cases for it, because I can go out and I can tell the story and they're going to say, who is this
guy? You're not a fisherman in that community.
No,
and
I have very low credibility in the fisherman's community. Yeah. I'm not the one that they're going to be listening to, but they're going to be listening to their colleagues who may go out and prove that there is a business case here and there is a way to stay on the water, to stay relevant in our food systems. Maybe it would also attract a new generation, you know, of young people to the fishery, because that's one of the really difficult things for most fisheries, is to attract young people, because who's going to be interested in working in a doomed business, right?
No.
It's just not fun.
And is your idea that those projects are being funded?
I think the initial process needs to be funded because you're not going to find a fisherman who will be investing his retirement funds in this. Super unsafe, not going to happen. But there are funding programs, and the two fishermen that we're working with now, they're both funded by external funding from the Danish authorities to set up their farms. So Hauhøst has applied for funding for them. So we set up their farms. We pay the fishermen for 2 years to work the farms.
So
we generate a business case, and then afterwards we can look into, okay, so how many hours have you spent? How much have you produced? Who would be interested in buying it? And we need real.
Yeah, you need the whole create the whole supply chain
because
having the oysters or mussels,
somebody has to buy them.
Yeah, have you ever imagined that this would come out like when you started 12 years ago?
No, never. But I think the thing is that it's very, very hard to oppose it. It's an idea which is very hard to oppose. There's nothing really bad about it. No one loses, right? It's just a matter of changing your thinking about, the ocean and cultivation and food, and what do fishermen do, what do people do, what do we eat? There's a lot of changed attitudes, but there's really no losers.
I cannot see any.
We all win.
Yeah.
So that it's an idea and a project that is it doesn't have any enemies, but that doesn't make it easy because there's a lot of inertia in the systems.
Yeah, but because it still works. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't work well.
No.
But
no.
If you look and if you don't want to see it, it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you close your eyes, I have my food. I mean, the ocean is still there.
Yeah.
Okay. The fish is not there, but it will come back. It came back anytime.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
It takes some years, but then, no, it's not. It's not.
No, it's not. And, and this is a wonderful way, I think, this whole small scale cultivation thing is a wonderful way for people to take part and to get involved in this whole transition. These community gardens where normal people can just sign up and be a part of a blue community garden and go out there and do it. It's a wonderful way for people to take an active responsibility for the changes that we need to see happening.
You see me finding this idea so great that I would love to be part of one of these communities. Yeah.
But there are some good, I know that we're working with some partners in Kiel.
Yeah.
There is a wonderful farm in Kiel called the Kiel Amires Farm.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
And they have done some really nice groundwork to promote this form of cultivation. And they're also working now to, set up like more community-based gardens and in Flensburg and along the German Baltic coast, there are some initiatives happening, and we're working like with an organization called EUCC Deutschland, working with coastal communities and business models, and they're trying to promote it also.
So you say it's growing?
Yeah, it is actually growing, but the thing is, in Germany, as in other countries, you need to make the first step really easy. Just do it. Get a small thing in the water, just a few lines.
As a private person.
As a private person
here in Denmark, what can I do? Can I go out and say, "Well, I have my mussels and I have my seaweed here. Yeah. How do I manage it?
You can. We
can
we,
I call you and say, send me a kit?
Yeah, you can.
We
developed. Many 10 years ago, we made this mussel kit, a do-it-yourself kit, a 10-meter-long mussel kit with like whatever what you need to set up a super small-scale farm.
Yeah.
And that kit ended up producing a new piece of legislation directed at super small-scale, because the authorities, when they saw this kit, they were like, okay, so if people start buying that kit from Hauhøst and start applying to set up mussel farms based on a 10 meter long line, and we in the authorities, we have to to deal with every single small farm as if it was a huge industrial farm. They could see, you know, their piles of work would just be endless because they would need to hire more people to enforce the same level of jurisdiction on all those applications. So they were certainly very interested, the authorities, in you know, creating a fast lane for the very small ones.
Mm-hmm.
So now in Denmark, it's just a question, when it comes to mussels, it's just a question of signing a form and saying, I want to put my mussel line on these coordinates. And then after 2 weeks, you have your permission. Super easy.
Whereas
no environmental assessments, no hearing processes with different authorities and blah, 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 all that is gone.
Mm.
And that's a nice template for other countries need to do it.
As you said, it has to be easy. Yeah. And it has to be easy for anyone, for the communities, for the single person who does it, and also for the fishermen and for the authorities. So this is much easier to do the stamp on it.
Exactly.
If you have a view like 10 years, in 10 years, where are we then?
I hope that we'll be, I hope that we will see that the coastal fishermen and, have started a revolution with cultivating these species in the ocean. I hope that we'll have, that all the Danish coastal cities that used to be like hotspots for fishery are now hotspots for these kinds of cultivation practices. And that fishery has found its way into a mix of activities with cultivation, I think. And I hope that we'll also see that young people will start thinking about a career in ocean cultivation as something worth looking into, because it brings you into contact with nature, with the oceans, with food, with local restaurants, and that there's a lot of interesting. It makes you an environmental worker, a climate worker, a food worker, and it just somehow that just I can see that as something that could generate interest from young people. Maybe not young people who would otherwise choose a university degree, but some people who may not want to enter into an academic career. We've had a lot of in Denmark, there's been a lot of discrediting of manual labor. People who do work with their hands are not seen as valuable as people who do work with their hands in front of heads in front of computers. I think we can produce a career here which is completely aligned with where we need to go as a society, and which makes people who work with their hands gives them an opportunity to go out and fulfill a really important role in our communities. I would love to see that, and I hope that it will have spread also to other countries. We're working now also with some people in France and Norway, and there's a lot of interest going on, and
very emotional.
Things are happening, and I think that would be my dream for in 10 years, that we'll have a vibrant community across Europe, and small scale cultivation will be something we'll see.
I'm just asking myself, was there a history in our in consuming seaweed in Scandinavia and Germany? I don't know that. Were people eating seaweed in the past?
People were eating seaweed, and we don't know. There are some Irish cases where it's
Ireland. Yeah. I know.
Yeah, and there are also some
Britannia.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
Yeah.
There are no in Denmark when we look into the culture, the food culture of the past. It's more related to oysters and mussels.
Yeah,
there was a huge consumption of these species in the past, like 6,000-8,000 years ago. It was a major part of the of the diet of people living along the coastlines, because they were all over the place, and they were they didn't swim away when you tried to catch them.
Easy to catch,
maybe a little bit harder to open, but at that time people just threw them into the fire and they opened and you could eat them. So super easy and super healthy, full of all the things that we needed to get our minds and brains and bodies evolved into to what they are now. There are a few, you know, recipes from back in the day with seaweed,
yeah,
but it's very, 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 very limited.
What is your favorite recipe these days
actually,
with seaweed?
I think I like to see seaweed as a condiment more than as a primary ingredient.
Yeah.
It doesn't replace a steak, right? It replaces, it gives flavor to mm-hmm. food. It gives mouthfeel. It gives another sensation in to the food that you eat. I had a wonderful experience with a mussel burger a week ago. We prepared mussel burgers in Hauhust, which where you just like, you know, you with seaweed in it. Mm-hmm. So you had like you have your mussels and you steam them, you take them out of the shells, chop them finely, make them into a patty with eggs and herbs and make a nice patty
the regular way, then.
And you fry them in a lot of oil, and you get these and put in seaweed because that's just perfect, you know, mussels.
And how
seaweed.
Do you prepare the seaweed?
Take dried seaweed,
and
you can get that. The easy thing there is that you can get them in most health stores and stuff. You can get bags of
dried
seaweed,
and then you
super easy to deal with. You can have it; they have an, eternal shelf life, so you can just have it in a like next to your other spices and stuff that you have in your kitchen. You have a bag of seaweed. Yeah. Maybe you have two or three different kinds of seaweed. You have some mixes, maybe, and you end up finding out, what is it good for. But seaweed is super good with ocean food, mm-hmm. including mussels.
Yeah.
So a mussel patty with dried seaweed added in, super umami flavor.
Yeah.
And super burgery experience. That's what you want for your burger. I would recommend that to anyone. Just a mussel and seaweed
this
burger.
This is a very good idea.
It's wonderful. Everyone likes it.
Everyone likes it.
Everyone likes
it. Yeah,
exactly. It's just a patty.
Yeah.
And you can, we prepare it sometimes with the school classes that we have come down and visit us. They all like it.
Cool.
Nothing not to like.
This is a good idea. I will try that.
Yeah.
I had butter, kombu butter.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Just good roasted.
Yeah.
Just
yeah,
roast yeah. the dry and, yeah. and then... grind it and then make it it's a perfect entry for those who say I would never eat algae.
Use it with nuts, like fry peanuts, do the same, like grind it, have it finely grounded and mix it with some peanuts fried on a pan, like, so you get the nuts and the grounded seaweed together on a pan, releases fantastic aromas. Take it off, and you just have it as a snack.
And don't need to salt it.
No, but it's just outrageous. And, we should all be eating that as a snack. But that's what we started when we started talking, right? It's about finding ways into what we already eat.
Yeah.
It's not about eating entirely new dishes based on stuff that we're never going to be able to manipulate into what we eat on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But we all eat peanuts, right? We are, Saturday evening, we have a glass
local
of wine
peanuts.
And some peanuts. Local peanuts, obviously. But, just fry them a little bit with some dried seaweed, and you just have an entirely different experience. It's familiar, and it's better than what you would normally have.
Yeah.
That's the future of food.
That's the future of food. I mean, as I said before, did you have ever thought that this would come up? It was your idea with a few oysters in the Copenhagen harbor.
Yeah, and here we go. Huh? Yeah, it is. It's funny how these journeys they begin and how they develop. But the thing was obviously that that I think the whole concept of regeneration came in mm-hmm. much later, only after 4 or 5 years or something. We saw that's But you know how it is, that you do something and then you start putting words on it and that you understand it. Suddenly you understand it. Suddenly there's a word that encapsulates all the things that you've been thinking and dreaming. And regenerative, that's exactly what this is about. This is about combining ecosystem restoration with food production. Simple. That's what this is about.
Very simple.
Very simple.
Are you proud?
I'm proud when I see all the stuff that's going on now. It's amazing, especially when I look into that whole Cool Blue Future platform and, you know, seeing all the interest from 9 countries now around us that are looking at what we've been doing in Denmark for the past 10 years. I'm like, okay. But at the same time, I'm also a little bit discouraged by the fact that, you know, that we are getting so much attention for doing so little. It feels like a very small contribution that we're giving to the world. Mm. And in a way, it's a little bit sad that that small contribution is seen as so big, because it just makes me like, is this really where we're at?
Yeah.
You know, shouldn't someone else who's actually doing something really, really important and making huge changes right now, where are they? We're often asked also, you know, so these small farms that you're making and these small community farms and small coastal, what is their real effect on the environment, you know, on the ocean? You know, they're small. Can mm-hmm. they really have an effect on the whole, on the huge ecosystems in the ocean? And I'm like, no, maybe not. But I think that the real change that we can hope to generate is probably also in the heads of the people who engage with all that we do, the school children who visit our gardens, the members of the gardens, the fishermen, all the people in that whole ecosystem around us. I think that's where the real effect of Havhøst is probably to be seen, mm-hmm. is that we all think of ourselves a little bit differently. We understand the world a little bit better through Havhøst.
Yeah. I mean, it's the impulse you give and as you said, I mean, the community gardens based in harbors, people pass by, people ask. I mean,
exactly.
This is worth a lot, I think.
Yeah. No? I hope so. I hope it'll, I think so. I think that's why I said that before also, that, you know, to me, the most meaningful part of all this is the kids who come and visit our gardens, because that's where the real change is going to come from. They go home as ambassadors. I hope that we've just pushed a little bit on their conception of themselves as future consumers, as citizens of countries that, you know, need to engage with the natural world in a novel way.
That was a good last word. Perfect.
Yeah.
I thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joachim.
Yeah.
It was great to be here.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to have my next meal with oysters, blue mussels, and of course, seaweed.
Yes. Welcome back another time.
If I find a new recipe, a good recipe, I'll let you know.
Please do. Always interesting.
Yeah. We do so.
Yeah.
Spread the word.
Spread the word.
Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Und wir sagen herzlichen Dank fürs Zuhören. Schön, dass du dabei warst. Und wir hoffen natürlich, dass du das Thema Algen genauso spannend findest wie wir und freuen uns, wenn du auch bei der nächsten Folge dabei bist und diesen Podcast abonnierst, folgst und natürlich auch empfiehlst. Dieser Podcast erscheint im Übrigen monatlich. Und ganz besonders freuen wir uns natürlich über eure Bewertungen und Kommentare bei Apple Podcast und Spotify. Denn das sorgt dafür, dass der Algentalk sichtbarer wird und mehr Aufmerksamkeit bekommt. Ihr könnt euch auf jeden Fall freuen auf die nächste Folge, die in einem Monat erscheint. Und bis dahin alles Gute und probiert mal ein paar Algen.